her state. Chavez himself was born in Arizona in 1927. His family lost its home in the Great Depression and moved to California to work the fields with other migrant workers. President Barack Obama tells more of the story when he dedicated the Cesar Chavez National Monument October 8, 2012 in Keene, California.
Cesar wasn't easy on his parents. He described himself as caprichoso, capricious. His brother Richard had another word for him, stubborn. By the time he reached seventh grade, Cesar estimated he had attended 65 elementary schools, following the crop cycles with his family, working odd jobs, sometimes living in roadside tents without electricity or plumbing. It wasn't an easy childhood, but Cesar always was different. While other kids could identify all the hottest cars, he memorized the names of labor leaders and politicians. After serving in the Navy during World War II, Cesar returned to the fields. And it was a time of great change in America, but too often that change was only framed in terms of war and peace, black and white, young and old. No one seemed to care about the invisible farm workers who picked the nation's food, bent down in the beating sun, living in poverty, cheated by growers, abandoned in old age, unable to demand even the most basic rights. But Cesar cared. And in his own peaceful, eloquent way, he made other people care too.
Oregon State University's Jose Antonio Orozco researched how Cesar Chavez learned to care for his 2008 book about Chavez for the University of New Mexico Press.
When Cesar was asked, like, who was really your inspiration for learning about nonviolence, he always pointed back and said that it was his mother and the practices of his mother. She would, at that time, would try to prepare meals for homeless people in the community. She would try to do acts of charity and so forth. And so from a very early age, he says that he was brought up in the idea of service to people who were needy.
Jose Antonio, you mentioned two life-altering encounters that Cesar Chavez had, one with Father Donald McDonald, who was a parish priest and a labor organizer. And you said that he instigated Cesar's love of reading and passion for nonviolence. So one of the individuals that Cesar met through the books was St. Francis of Assisi.
When he finally met Father McDonald, the idea was that he was brought into kind of a formal education and the kinds of practices that he had already been doing. And so learning about St. Francis, he started learning about what it means to deepen those practices of nonviolence and how that ties into the question about faith and the love of God. But it was something that he had already been living from an early childhood through his mother's practices, this kind of a folk Mexican-American Catholicism, which was really, really deep in his family.
Is there anything about St. Francis's story that we might need to know to understand the connection to peace and nonviolence? Some don't know that story.
I think that was something that was really impactful for Cesar about St. Francis was the connections to nature and to animals in particular. So St. Francis always believed that it was important to, in some sense, right, commune with nature and to think of nature as a living, breathing, whole system, sort of a pre-kind of ecological consciousness, and to think about nature as a being that we must be in relationship with, and that animals are themselves sentient beings who have personalities and lives and thoughts that we can take into account in our own lives. And I think that this impacted Cesar into understanding and appreciation that nature is not just natural resources, but it's something that we have to take into account. It's something that nourishes us, that feeds us, that is part of our own lives and bodies. And I think, quite frankly, this probably affected his own decisions later on in life to become a vegetarian. He was quite honored later on in life for emphasizing that a peaceful, nonviolent life means one about treating animals well and humanely in various ways. And so for him, that meant that he had to become a vegetarian.
It sounds like also that there was something about his readings of St. Francis and also Gandhi that really impacted him.
Yeah, I think that part of it was is that he saw a connection a much greater connection from his own experiences to these other folks around the world. He was able to see this kind of idea of service to the least advantaged in society was something that was part of a much broader human experience. And from Gandhi and from reading Thoreau, he was also able to see that this was a political practice, and this was more than just about charity, but it was about trying to understand how power structures create disadvantaged people, and that we can work to change those power structures.
Cesar Chavez also met Fred Ross, who was an organizer who became his, I guess, lifelong friend and mentor, and he hired him to be an organizer.
Yeah, the story in terms of how they met was is really a great one. Fred Ross was an organizer with an organization called the Community Services Organization that was an offshoot of the Saul Alinsky groups back in Chicago. And the job of the Community Service Organization was to help organize urban Mexican-Americans in California to do voter drives and to organize to protect themselves against police brutality in California and also just to get involved in city politics. Fred Ross was sent out as an organizer into the Barrio Sal Si Puedes, which means get out if you can, which was near San Jose, California. And Cesar Chavez was a young man at the time, and he sort of styled himself, he said at the time, as a young pachuco thug. And they heard that there was some white man walking around the neighborhood talking to people, and they were trying to figure out who he was because they were used to social workers and police officers coming into town and disrupting things, and so they were trying to figure out who this guy was. And so Fred Ross organized a house meeting, which was one of the tactics that the CSO tried to get, is get people together in the house of a neighbor or someone in the community and talk about the ways in which they could get together to organize, to take power, and to control their own lives. And so they heard that Fred Ross was having a house meeting, and he and Cesar Chavez and some of his friends said, hey, well, what we'll do is we'll go to this meeting. And then Cesar Chavez said, I'll give a signal. When I give the signal, then we're going to mess this guy up. And so they went to the house meeting, and Fred Ross started talking about a case of police brutality in Los Angeles that was very notorious at the time, where the police had beaten several Mexican-American prisoners in the city jail and had gotten away with it. And Fred Ross was telling them, look, this there are ways that we can deal with this. We can take, we're waiting for him to give this. And Cesar found that he was instead really interested in what Fred Ross had to say. He had never thought that there could be a possibility of community members doing something to protect themselves against police brutality, of taking control of the city politics, of being able to change their circumstances. And so he said later on that he never gave that signal because he wanted to hear what Fred Ross had to say. And after Fred Ross finished talking, Cesar said he signed up immediately because he figured that it was better to try to become an organizer than to continue his life as a pachuco thug.
Someone else who had joined the community service organization was Dolores Huerta. She told Carol Boss that's how she met Cesar Chavez and how they began their historic journey together.
I was a volunteer. Cesar was a staff person. What we had in common was that we were both concerned about the condition of farm workers. And eventually that joint care that we had is what eventually led us to leave the community service organization because they didn't want to support an effort to organize farm workers. Although we had planned it in advance, we thought we had everybody's approval. When it came to our convention, they voted it down. So both Cesar and I left the community service organization to start the farm workers union.
So when you first met, what was it, about 1955 or so?
Yes. I joined the organization in 55. I think he had joined the year before that.
What would you say were some of those formative moments? You both thought it was important to organize farm workers.
Well, we know that although the conditions of the Latinos and Mexican Americans in the cities was pretty bad, the condition of the farm workers was very, very bad. So this is why we decided to, at some point, I came to the realization that the farm workers needed a union. And, of course, Esther came to the same realization. And we were still in CSO thinking about, well, if they do not support this pilot program to organize farm workers, then we'll just leave. And at that point, and I remember those words, like they're just, if I say, written in my mind, where he said, if we don't start a union for farm workers, they will never have a union. And then he said in the next breath, but we will not see a national union in our lifetime. And I said, why, Cesar? He said, because the growers are too rich, they're too powerful, and they're too racist.
Did he talk early on about nonviolence?
That was interesting because both Cesar and myself had both read Gandhi. And, of course, when I met Cesar, I didn't know that he had read Gandhi. And that was another point that we had in common. And just the whole idea of everything that Gandhi did in India to, you know, overturn the British rule of India, but he did it through nonviolence. So, you know, we both had that commitment. And, of course, in the farm workers movement, many of the methods that we used to combat violence was, again, following Gandhi's. I mean, the march that we did, when we marched from Delano to Sacramento, it was not a march. We called it a pilgrimage. And we called it a pilgrimage because we wanted the farm workers to not think in terms of vindictiveness or revenge, but to think more in terms of prayer, offering, sacrifice. When we did our fast, of course, Cesar was very well known for the fast that he did. He did three fasts. His first fast was for 25 days dedicated to nonviolence, and that was here in Delano, California. His second fast was in Arizona, another 25-day water only, by the way. All he took was water and Holy Communion. The third fast that he did was a 36-day fast, and that one he did against the use of pesticide. But the way that he framed it is he said that I'm doing this fast, and I'm paraphrasing, of course, I'm doing this fast to take away the hatred out of the hearts of the growers. And also, if there is hatred in the hearts of the farm workers, then I want that also to be removed.
In the summer of 1965, it seemed like strike fever was sweeping California, and I wanted to ask you to describe the scene in the meeting halls on the day of the vote to walk out of the vineyard in that summer.
And I do want to add to that question because a lot of people think, oh, well, Caesar strolled to the fields or went into a field to talk to farm workers and everybody came out on strike. It didn't happen that way at all. We started organizing farm workers in 1962. When we left the community service organization, and the strike did not start till 1965. During those 3 years, there was a lot of painstaking organizing, you know, meeting with farm workers in their homes, meeting with families, convincing them that they had power, convincing them that they could make changes, convincing them that if they didn't do this, nobody was going to do it for them. So in 1965, when the strike happened, the workers were already organized. We also had service programs where we started a credit union for the farm workers, the first one in the whole history of the United States for farm workers. And, you know, we helped people with their immigration work that they needed, income taxes, any kind of issues that they had to do with law enforcement. So we built a very strong base. So when we had that big meeting in 1965, since the Filipino farm workers came out on strike, then we had to support them. But it was, of course, very thrilling when we got the workers together, and you know, then they had to take a strike vote, and when they did, of course, it was very exhilarating.
It sounded like cries of strike literally rocked the meeting halls.
Well, yes, it did, and it was very scary for the workers too, because you're talking about people that were very poor. When we went out on strike in 1965, the wages for the farm workers were like 90 cents an hour. And the initial strike, we said we're going to strike for $1.25. And within a couple of months, the growers raised the wages to $1.25. But then we knew that the real issue was getting recognition, getting the rights that the workers could have representation so that they could have collective bargaining agreements, which really bound the growers legally. Not only could they had to raise the wages, and the workers could negotiate their wages, but that they also had to provide other benefits like drinking water, toilets, unemployment insurance, things that the workers did not have. Protections against when they would be fired unjustly or, you know, laid off when they shouldn't have been laid off. So they needed additional protections, not just wages. And that's what a collective bargaining agreement is, between employers and their workers. And that's what we were shooting for, getting something that was enforceable by law, and it couldn't just be taken away.
Of course, that strike grew into a national boycott, and you directed that national boycott, didn't you?
Well, we actually split it up into regions. I ran the boycott from Chicago to New York, from Canada to Florida on the East Coast. And after we were able, and then we had other people that ran it on the West Coast. But we were able to get the East Coast clean of grapes, and then I came back and then I took over the boycott on the West Coast also. And I that's another, when we think of the boycott, we have to think of that as a nonviolent economic strategy. Because since we couldn't win in the fields, you know, we were getting arrested. They had these court injunctions on us that limited the number of pickets that we could have at a 1,000-acre field, only 5 people to a field, so that the strikebreakers couldn't even see us. And that's why we had to go to the boycott. But it is a nonviolent way of, you know, bringing people, they say, in this case, bringing the growers to the negotiating table once they couldn't sell their grapes.
We'll continue to vote and get people to vote, but really, really, there's another place we can vote and be extremely successful, and that's the marketplace.
Later in his life, Cesar Chavez addressed a community group about the power of the boycott.
And so we say, why go to the politicians? Why not go directly and go to the marketplace where you can put direct pressure on those corporations? They can find a solution for you. That, we recommend that. And we live long enough to know that it works. You see, we hear that, the old cliche that politics makes strange bedfellows. Boycotts make stranger bedfellows still. We can learn a lot from Dr. King and from Gandhi. You know, on the bus boycott, there was no way in the world that those blacks could have ever won it politically. They couldn't. Politically, they didn't have any power. And they came up with the idea of the boycott. And the boycott began to work. Gandhi's boycotts, some were tremendous, some were strokes of geniuses. They liberated the whole country without war. We dismissed it because there wasn't a shooting war, so that's not important. But we should reflect on those instances when things were done without a shooting war. Those are important things to reflect on, understand, and appreciate, and try to replicate.
When things get done without a shooting war, that's what we should try to replicate, says Cesar Chavez in a talk late from his life posted to YouTube. We have a link on our website, peacetalksradio.com, and we'll have more from all of our guests on this program when we return on this special edition of Peace Talks Radio, The Nonviolent Path of Cesar Chavez, more after this break. This is a Peace Talks Radio special, The Nonviolent Path of Cesar Chavez. We have more at peacetalksradio.com. I'm Paul Ingalls with Carol Boss.
Cesar himself worked for 20 years as an organizer without a single major victory. Think about that.
We're hearing more now from President Barack Obama's dedication of the Cesar Chavez National Monument in Keene, California in October of 2012.
But he refused to give up. He refused to scale back his dreams. He just kept fasting and marching and speaking out, confident that his day would come. And when it finally did, he still wasn't satisfied. After the struggle for higher wages, Caesar pushed for fresh drinking water and workers' compensation, for pension plans and safety from pesticides. Always moving, always striving for the America he knew we could be. More than anything, that's what I hope our children and grandchildren will take away from this place. Every time somebody's son or daughter comes and learns about the history of this movement, I want them to know that our journey is never hopeless. Our work is never done. I want them to learn about a small man guided by enormous faith in a righteous cause, a loving God, the dignity of every human being. I want them to remember that true courage is revealed when the night is darkest and the resistance is strongest, and we somehow find it within ourselves to stand up for what we believe in. Caesar once wrote a prayer for the farm workers that ends with these words: "Let the spirit flourish and grow so that we will never tire of the struggle." Let us remember those who have died for justice, for they have given us life. Help us love even those who hate, so we can change the world. Our world is a better place because Cesar Chavez decided to change it. Let us honor his memory, but most importantly, let's live up to his example.
Carol Boss continues her conversation with Oregon State University professor Jose Antonio Orozco, author of Cesar Chavez and the Common Sense of Nonviolence.
In your book, you say the Delano grape strike serves as the context for Cesar to develop his tactics and his vision of nonviolent direct action.
Well, the Delano strike was really the initial struggle for the burgeoning United Farm Workers that started in 1962, 1963. Cesar Chavez was an organizer for Fred Ross's organization for about 10 years. And so he had stability as an organizer. He had a steady income and a house and a car and several children to take care of. And what's the striking thing about Cesar Chavez is that Cesar Chavez decided to give all of that up to try to form the farm workers. So he gave up all of this stability and security to try to work for people that he felt were being ignored, even by an organization like the Community Services Organization. So he sort of fits this kind of story of the self-made man, the person who takes a risk and risks it all to try to fulfill a quest. And the quest was working for the social justice of the farm workers. And so he gave that all up. And for about 2 years or so, he and Helen Chavez, his wife, and Dolores Huerta worked together with no money other than the savings that they had put together to try to build a farm worker union amongst the Filipino and the Mexican-American workers in the Central Valley of California. The grape strike was, in some sense, their first effort to build solidarity. And what was really unique about the strike, I think, is the way in which it was more than just a pure labor strike, but it turned into a social movement. It turned into a rallying call for Mexican Americans in California to see solidarity between the farm workers and young Chicanos and Chicanas in the cities, and also with folks in other parts of the country who started to see that the conditions under which farm workers were struggling with in California, the people who were producing the food that they were eating, were abysmal, and that they needed to, as consumers of that food, to get on board. So what I think the grape strike represents is an attempt to try to expand labor struggles beyond that into real big social movements that involve students and consumers and intellectuals and the workers themselves into a movement for social justice.
Well, what we did, again, organizing people in communities. We had farm workers that went from the farm worker towns all the way to New York City, to Chicago, to Canada.
Again, Dolores Huerta.
And the farm workers then would go to churches, speak to people at churches, speak to labor union meetings that they had, community organizations, and just getting people to support and not buy grapes. But more than that, organizing people to set up picket lines in front of stores. And when they would picket the stores, all of these volunteers that came out to help us, then the stores would take the grapes out. So eventually we were able to get the major chains to take the grapes out of all of their stores, and then get people to stop buying grapes altogether. So it became a huge movement, and so we had millions of people, literally, all over the United States that stopped eating grapes, and not only the United States, but also in Canada, in Mexico, and of course in Europe.
Well, I remember reading, for me, it was a very vivid picture of sit-ins in Chicago, right in the middle of a store, inside the store, sit-ins, and these were in the big chains. So that really had to take a bit of courage on the part of those who were participating.
Yes, it did. And many of those that were housewives or they were students, so they were just people out there in the cities, and they came forward to support the farm workers. But again, we have to go back to the organizing part of this. It just didn't happen. Farm workers went out there and made this happen, you know, by speaking and recruiting people, getting people to support us on those picket lines. So it was very exciting.
Could you take us through, let's say, an argument to even one person who you were trying to convince not to buy grapes, someone who really couldn't understand? What would you say to them?
Well, for the most part, people were very sympathetic, and the message was simple. You know, we have farm workers in California are on strike. Farm workers don't have toilets in the fields. They don't have drinking water. They don't have any protections from pesticides. And we need your help. We need your help to support the farm workers so they can get the basic rights that other workers have had for since the 30s. These are rights that farm workers do not have. And people responded to that.
So you were basically asking them to employ empathy.
Pretty much. And, you know, people in our country do have good hearts, as we know, but often they just don't know what the circumstances are. But once they understand what the conditions of the workers were, and when you have farm workers themselves that are telling the story, and people can see in their faces and see, you know, hear directly from them, it was a very, very powerful message.
In March 1966, that walk, 300-mile walk from Delano to Sacramento, California's capital, which was really a way of dramatizing this what was already a six-month-old grape strike. And I know that one goal was to stress nonviolence and make more visible the nonviolent tactics. Why was that an important goal of the march?
Well, because the history, when you look at the history of labor organizing in the fields of California, it had always been one of violence. If you read John Steinbeck's novels, you know, The Grapes of Wrath, the other novels that he wrote about the early strikes that they had in California, and there was violence and people were killed. And before we started the union, Cesar and myself, we did a lot of research, and we didn't want that to happen again. We didn't want the people to turn to violence, either on the part of the farm workers or on the part of the growers. Of course, eventually, you know, we did have people that were killed. We have 5 martyrs that were killed in the farm workers movement. But and Cesar, one of the things that he always stressed is that if we turn to violence, we'll use it against each other. You know, so we have to stay away from violence. And he actually made everybody take a standing vow that we would not resort to violence. And that's why when we did that march, it was a pilgrimage. And I remember when we had the meeting to talk about going to Sacramento, many of the farm workers said, well, what do we have to be penitential about? You know, we're the victims. The growers are the ones that are abusing us and not respecting our work. And then he said, well, let's look at each other. Let's look at our families and see. Let's think about what have we done that maybe we should ask an apology or forgiveness for. All of us, we all have things that we do to each other that we need to be penitent about. And so, and of course, throughout the pilgrimage, starting in Delano, every single night we had a mass and we had a rally. So the whole spiritual part of the movement was very much a part of the pilgrimage. The other thing was the pilgrimage did not go through the big cities. It went through all of the farm worker towns. When the pilgrimage started, as they left Delano, California, There were probably, I would say, 70 to 90 farm workers. It started by the time that the farm workers and Caesar arrived in Sacramento. There were 10,000 people there.
We're fighting for recognition, which is the real guts of it. It doesn't matter now how much money they're offered. They wouldn't go back because what they want is a union before they go back.
This is Peace Talks Radio, and we're talking to Jose Antonio Orozco, author of Cesar Chavez and the Common Sense of Nonviolence. So according to Chava, La Causa, as the farm workers' struggle was called, it attempted to improve the working conditions, of course, of farm workers, but he also saw it as developing a larger mission over time.
I think that Cesar Chavez saw at a certain part that the reason that the farm workers were struggling was an unequal power balance between the growers and the farm workers. And he started to see that it was about various kinds of power inequalities in American society in general. And he started to see, he makes this connection between the violence that he saw when the growers would call the police out or they would hire security to protect the fields and that they would push the farm workers around. He saw connections between that kind of violence that was going on and violence and in the streets and in the riots during the 1960s. And then also the idea of the United States being involved in Vietnam. And so he started to see that there were connections of structural violence around the world and started to put all of this together that, you know, the reason that the farm workers were struggling was that because agriculture was becoming corporatized and that there were people who were willing to use violence to protect those corporate interests against the interests of the farm workers.
The movement gained the support of New York Senator Robert Kennedy, who during hearings by the Senate's Migratory Subcommittee quizzed a local California sheriff about forceful tactics used against the workers.
If I have reason to believe that there's going to be a riot started and somebody tells me that there's going to be trouble if you don't stop them, then it's my duty to stop them.
And then you go out and arrest them?
Well, absolutely.
And charge them?
Charge them.
What do you charge them with?
Violating unlawful assemblage.
Who told you that they're going to riot?
The men right out in the field that they were talking to said, if you don't get them out of here, we're going to cut their hearts out. So rather than let them get cut, you remove the cause.
This is the most interesting concept, I think. The fact that somebody makes a report about somebody's going to get out of order, perhaps violate the law, and you go in and arrest them. They haven't done anything wrong. How can you go arrest somebody if they haven't violated the law?
They're ready to violate the law, in other words.
Could I suggest from the luncheon period of time that the sheriff and the district attorney read the Constitution of the United States?
Kennedy!
We have to come clearly to the conclusion that an ignored part of our population have been the farm workers. That the farm workers have suffered in our society over the period of the last 30 years, and that situation has to be changed.
So there was a rally, I think it was March 1968, in a park in Delano at the end of Cesar's fast, and there were a good several thousand people there, and Robert Kennedy had flown in to celebrate the end of Chavez's fast, and it was just a week later that he announced he was running for the Democratic nomination for president. He'd become your friend. He was the union's friend.
Oh, yes. We worked very hard. We actually knew the senator before the fast, and he had already done some work for us. He had raised money for one of our volunteer clinics, and he had been out. Actually, he was in Delano before we started the pilgrimage. He had been there a couple of days before to do a hearing. And so he had already been very friendly to us. In fact, the police tried to stop the pilgrimage, which was ridiculous. They went and they were actually had, when the pilgrimage started, there was a whole line of police in front of the marchers. And Senator Kennedy had to call the chief of police and ask him, what did he think he was doing, that he was going to try to stop this pilgrimage? It was ridiculous. But he had been very close to us. And, of course, we all worked very hard. We were, you know, doing the campaign for him in Los Angeles and East Los Angeles and South Central Los Angeles, getting people to vote for Senator Kennedy. So he had been a very good friend from the very beginning of our movement.
And you were on the stage standing right beside him the night of his winning the California Democratic presidential primary. And, of course, that was the unforgettable evening when he was shot.
Well, it was a huge loss for the world, not just for the farmers' movement, but for everybody, because we know that our history in the United States would be very different had he not been assassinated. But we were right in the middle of the great boycott during that time, and so we just had to keep moving forward and keep working, and it was a great loss.
More from Dolores Huerta and our other guests when we continue on this special edition of Peace Talks Radio, The Nonviolent Path of Cesar Chavez, back in a moment. You're listening to a Peace Talks radio special, The Nonviolent Path of Cesar Chavez. More on this and all the episodes in our series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution dating back to 2002 can be found at our website, peacetalksradio.com. That's peacetalksradio.com. I'm series producer Paul Ingalls with Carol Boss, who now speaks with one of the many people inspired by the work of Cesar Chavez. Juanita Valdez Cox grew up in a migrant farm working family in the Rio Grande Valley in southern Texas. Her father came to the U.S. from Mexico as part of the Bracero program, which allowed Mexican-born workers to enter the U.S. and work under contract to harvest for certain growers. She herself started working in the fields in the late 1950s, when she was just about 10 years old.
Being in school for maybe 6 months out of the year, and then having to drop out of school to go up north to states like Michigan, where we harvested a lot of cherry, to Ohio, where we did harvested lots and lots of tomato, to New Mexico, traveling most of the summer following the different crops so that we could then come back with a little bit of money. And my dad would, he bought like a one-room house, but then every time we would go up north, we would come back and add another room to the house until we had, you know, a two- or three-bedroom home. And that's mainly the life of many of the migrants. That's how it was. It was my dad and his brothers and their family and all of us traveling and then coming back and trying to catch up with the rest of the students. You know, with some of what we had missed while up north working in the fields.
What were the beginnings, and I'm wondering if your family experienced that, of the organizing efforts?
My mom and dad, like many other farm workers, joined the union in 1979 when Dolores Huerta, Cesar Chavez, and Fred Ross were organizing this area so that farm workers could have, like, you know, toilets in the fields or safe drinking water, would ban the use of the short handle hoe, would have like the minimum wage, which at that time was like $1.40. So they joined in 79. I think it was in February. I still have his union membership card, and that's why I remember those days.
I know there was a big convention that had happened there. It was the first one.
That's the one. That's the very first one. It was fabulous, yes.
That was a momentous event.
Yes, it was. It was hundreds of delegates. It was the very, very first farm worker convention ever in South Texas, and probably in the whole state of Texas.
Juanita Valdez Cox, do you remember seeing Cesar Chavez for the first time?
I was volunteering at the union, I remember him telling us some of the things that needed to be done here so that we could win those changes, so that we could make those changes. And I remember telling him, but we don't even have water in our colonia, because we didn't have water yet. And we don't even have paved streets, and we don't have, you know, all of the very basic necessities. And him saying, sort of telling us, well, you know, that's up to you. It is your responsibility. He says, at the end of the day, I can go back to California, and who's going to live without water, and who's going to live without the paved streets so that the bus can pick you up for school? At the time, maybe it was like, wow, he thinks we can do it. What impressed me was him believing that as farm workers, I could do something really to have an impact on our lives. He saw something in all of us before we saw it in us ourselves. I don't know, that's sort of confusing, but what I'm trying to say is that he had faith because he had worked with farm workers in California. He knew the power that we could have. And so when he did that, when he told us that, and not only one time, but many times over, about what we could do. And then when we started to work on it, and then we started to win, and then we started to totally believe and said, you know what? He's absolutely right. If we help feed this world, we have a lot of power. And we also need to have the respect. There are many wonderful memories of changes that have been made, but they also have come through a lot of sacrifice and some scars that remain, you know, in people's hearts and memories for a lifetime. But it's something that has to be recognized by everyone, is that those that are in the fields that bring those food to the stores, we need to think about them every time we eat, because it is because of them. And so we need to make sure that we work so that the laws that are now effective are respected and that they are enforced.
Can you talk briefly about the forces that moved you and inspired you to do the work that you're doing for your organization now? You're the executive director, I believe, of LUPE, which is La Unión de Pueblo Entero, Union of All the People?
Yes.
In other words, talk about how, in a sense, you're carrying on the work of Cesar Chavez and United Farm Workers.
I think that, you know, through all of the valuable lessons, not only from Cesar and Dolores, but from the farm workers themselves, willing to take a risk and say things have got to be different. We've got to work towards changing some of these laws. We've got to make life better for our children. Some of the same, you know, philosophy that Cesar has still carries on. It's part of our culture, and the work that we do is learning from the work that they did, learning and respecting what they did to bring us up to this point, and feeling a responsibility of making sure that it is moved into the future, that while there still remains injustices in the fields or in the communities, that we've got to continue this work that they started, that it is on their shoulders that we stand. All of our programs here at LUPE, for example, one of the big core values is self-help. And we just believe that if we live the problem, then we can be part of that solution, because we know it, we feel it, and we are going to feel the impact of the change. And therefore, we've got to be involved.
That's Juanita Valdez-Cox, who continues to look out for farm workers' issues in the South Texas area where she grew up in a migrant farm working family in the 1950s and 60s.
What's interesting is that typically when you talk about nonviolence, you have this kind of litany of heroes that are engaged in nonviolence. So people will say, oh yeah, Tolstoy, Thoreau, Gandhi, Martin Luther King, and sometimes they'll mention Chavez or Dolores Huerta. But I think that Chavez offers in his practice and in the way he talked about nonviolence was very, very different from the way in which, for instance, Gandhi and Martin Luther King thought about the effectiveness of nonviolence.
More now from Carol Boss's conversation with Jose Antonio Orozco, Oregon State University professor and Cesar Chavez scholar.
Gandhi's nonviolence was based on this sort of Hindu principle of ahimsa, or nonviolence. And for Gandhi, that meant that when you practice nonviolence, it's an all-encompassing worldview about not harming another individual. And so that means that you try to engage in not harming anyone mentally, spiritually, and physically. And practically speaking, that meant that when Gandhi would organize a protest or a demonstration or an act of civil disobedience, he thought it was very important for the protesters to inform the authorities thoroughly about what they were planning to do. So there was pre-notification of what was going to be going on, how the protesters were going to be engaging in civil disobedience, so that there were no surprises, that there were no secrets, and that everyone was above board, but that they would know that civil disobedience was going to take place. And for Gandhi, this, he believed that this was important, to be completely transparent in your actions to those who you consider to be your opponents. Chavez was much different than that. He believed, I think, what we might call more in a politics of disruption. Tactics that would be disruptive to the status quo, that would get tension going on, but were not necessarily all above board, so to speak. So, for instance, during the grape strike, the farm workers engaged in what was called planes de tortuga, which translates to turtle plans. And so what this meant practically was that farm workers would plan to work very slowly in picking the grapes. And as anyone who's ever worked in grape harvest knows, that the temperatures in the valley in California get very, very hot, and grapes are very, very fragile. And if they're not picked at the right time in the right way, they can be essentially just useless for production. And so what the farm workers would do, they would work very slowly and not harvest as quickly as necessary, threatening to destroy many growers' harvests. And the attempt here was to try to coerce the growers to come to contracts. Another tactic was something that they called submarines, in other words, because in many cases the farm workers had been prohibited from picketing near the farms and near the growers' homes, they didn't have any access to the workers in the fields to try to organize them to join the union. So what they would happen is they would send a submarine in, that is, someone undercover, a union member who would go in and start working at a grower's field, claim that they were not a union member, and then get in and start working to organize the members in the field. And so it was all in secret, and it was all not above board, but it was an attempt to try to get underneath the legal injunctions that were preventing them from talking to farm workers. And finally, I think that some of the tactics that you started to see in the East Coast particularly were very, very disruptive during the grape boycott. I've talked to UFW members who said that one of the things that they did, for instance, back in New York, in places like in Long Island and Brooklyn, they would go to Safeway supermarkets, which were one of the grocery chains that was being pressured by the UFW to stop using non-union grapes. And the UFW members would go into the stores, and they would start filling up baskets with food so that they were just piled high, high up. And they would go to the cashier, and then they would ask the cashier, "Are the grapes here union?" And if the cashiers most likely would probably say no, then the UFW members would say, "Well, then I don't want to shop here anymore," and they would walk out. And what that would do is that they would force then the workers to have to take time to restock all of those items. And so there were all of these kinds of tactics about disruption, about making sure that the status quo couldn't be the same.
So Gandhi probably wouldn't have thought that was morally justified.
No, any kind of secrecy like that was not treating your opponent with ahimsa. But for Chavez, given that he got his training, I think, from the labor movement, it was necessary to think about how to shift forces and balances of power. And he didn't believe, of course, in violence, but he did believe that sometimes in order to achieve justice, you have to create tension in a community. You have to create a kind of disruption so that the status quo, which is of injustice, cannot continue. And this is, of course, something that Martin Luther King talked about in his letter from a Birmingham jail, of creative tension necessary to disrupt the status quo. But Chavez was willing to engage in politics that I think Gandhi would not have thought appropriate for a person of nonviolence.
Can you point to applications today of nonviolence that are based on Cesar Chavez's ideas, his visions, his tactics?
The emphasis that Cesar Chavez had in his organizing was a big dedication to helping train people to live in a democratic society. And that means training people to realize that they have a right and they ought to have a say in the kinds of decisions that will affect their lives. And so Chavez said very often that the nonviolent actions and civil disobedience ought to be a training school for the people who are involved in those actions. And so he said the picket line, he said, is the greatest school for democracy. You train people how to work together, how to rely on one another to accomplish common goals together. And so I think that the emphasis that Cesar Chavez had in his forms of organizing direct actions was about making sure that you're trying to accomplish a goal with your action, but also in the process, you're helping people to learn the kinds of skills that they need to work together to develop consensus and to build solidarity with one another. He was always very suspicious, for instance, of revolutionaries in Latin America who talked about overthrowing the power structure and freeing people and liberating themselves. But his question was always, well, what then? What happens after the revolution? What happens when you have removed a dictator through violence? Why doesn't that just simply justify the use of violence again against you if someone disagrees? He said, no, we can't go that route. What we need to do is we need to have training for democracy, and any kind of way in which we decide to shift power has to be one that trains people to live together after the revolution peacefully and to come to solve conflicts in a nonviolent way.
The boycott, the strike has been a costly thing not only to us but also to the employers. But I think that because, even though however unfortunate the experience might have been and the struggle on both sides, that because of that experience, we have created the foundation to what I think is going to be a very good working relationship with the grower community in Delano.
So it was in 1970, you got a call from Johnny Giamatto, who's part of that industry. Negotiations were successful. It was late in the night. Hands were shook and the room literally thundered with applause and shouts of joy. And I want to read a quote of Cesar's, and I want you to, if you can, to comment on it. Cesar said, without the help of those millions upon millions of people who believe as we do that nonviolence is the way to struggle, I'm sure we wouldn't be here today. The strikers and the people involved in this struggle sacrificed a lot, sacrificed all of their worldly possessions. 95% of the strikers lost their homes and their cars, but I think in losing these worldly possessions, they found themselves.
I think it encapsulates what the whole movement was about, and also a message for everybody out there that we do have to sacrifice. If we don't sacrifice, then things do not change. And if we do not come together, we do not organize, then all of the justice goals that we want to achieve are never going to happen. This is it. We've got to come together. We've got to organize, and that's the way the change happens. But the sacrificing, the nonviolence, is a very big part of it. In fact, I think it's the foundation.
With all of this experience behind you, what do you have to say about the current state of workers' rights?
Well, we know in the United States of America, generally speaking, workers' rights have been eroded and have been taken away from them. So we have just a very small percentage of our workforce that is now in the labor union. If we do not have are not organized into a labor organization, which we call a labor union, you don't have a middle class. If you don't have a middle class, you don't have a democracy. And I do want to add one thing to just again, since we do want the listeners to know what the accurate picture is. Right now, unfortunately, there are not very many contracts in the grape fields. We have a lot of pesticides on those grapes, and so I would say to folks, if you want to eat grapes, make sure they're organic, okay, and that they don't have pesticides on them.
UFW co-founder Dolores Huerta. For the complete versions of our interviews with all of our guests on today's program and a link to the PBS documentary episode called Chicano, The Struggle in the Fields, from which you heard some clips, you can visit our website, peacetalksradio.com. That's peacetalksradio.com, where you can hear this program again and all the programs in our series on peacemaking and nonviolent conflict resolution dating back to 2002. There also you can sign up for a free podcast and newsletter, order CDs, and help support the series with a tax-deductible contribution to the nonprofit organization that produces the program, separate and apart from your public radio station. Visit peacetalksradio.com. In addition to support from listeners like you, we also receive support from the Eric Oppenheimer Family Foundation, the McCune Charitable Foundation of New Mexico, the Paul Ray Peace Prize, and KUNM at the University of New Mexico. Nola Daves Moses is the executive director of Good Radio Shows Incorporated. Ali Adelman composed and performs our theme music. For Carol Boss, I'm Paul Ingalls. Thanks for listening to and for supporting Peace Talks Radio.
Joanne Rand and Jim Page. Together, Rand and Page will pack a Cascadian folk wallop celebrating Rand's new album, Still a Real World, at the Alberta Rose Theatre on Tuesday, April 8th at 8 p.m. A portion of the proceeds from this amazing show will benefit KVU, so you folk fans don't want to miss this one. For more details, go to kboo.fm and check under Community Events here at your community radio station, KVU.
KBOO is proud to co-sponsor the Triangle production, Next Fall. Next Fall opens March 13th and runs through April 6th at the Sanctuary, 1785 Northeast Sandy Boulevard in Portland. Triangle Productions is partnering with Basic Rights Oregon in a talkback presentation after the show, which is set in present-day New York and contains flashbacks through a couple's relationship, how it began, and how it might end. Again, that's Next Fall by Triangle Productions, running through April 6th at the Sanctuary. More information can be found on the right-hand side of kboo.fm under Community Events.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, heard on translators K220HR Hood River, K282BH Philomath. Coming up next on KBOO is Labor Radio. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Redirect Guide, committed to promoting progressive regional businesses based upon the values of sustainability, localism, and social justice. Complete business directory and resource guide at redirect.com.
To you, the 9-to-5-er, just making your way home. To you, the all-night driver, out in your cab alone. To you, waiting for lunch break, as the minutes drag so slow. Take courage, turn the volume up, it's Labor Radio.
Welcome to Fifth Monday Labor Radio. I'm Michael Morrow. I'll be your host for tonight's show. Lane Ponce sends her best from somewhere in Italy, and Tim Flanagan sends his best from somewhere in Montana. I send you my best from the KBOO studios here, KBOO, and that's Mike on the boards that you just heard. I've got two guests with me tonight in the studio. We're going to have an interesting conversation. With me are Juan Carlos Ordonez, the Communication Director for the Oregon Center for Public Policy, and Scott Moore, also the Communication Director, but for Our Oregon. I'd like to take a minute to set up the context of the show, if I might do that. As many folks who belong to unions in Oregon realized, we dodged a bullet last month when Governor Kitzhaber was able to negotiate an initiative truce. Possible initiatives funded by the Koch brothers and the DeVos family that were going to be seriously anti-union were pulled from November's ballot, in exchange for which groups like Our Oregon pulled what we're calling tax fairness initiatives. Seems to me that maybe wealthy folks hate taxes more than they hate unions. This got me thinking, as a retired community college teacher and an AFT member, married to a retired K-12 teacher and an OEA member, about what the future holds for Oregon, especially for education and education funding. I moved here in the mid-70s and When I came, Oregon ranked about the middle of the 50 states with respect to K-12 and higher ed funding. Today, unfortunately, as many of us realize, we're pretty close to the bottom. It wasn't that many years ago that a prominent Republican legislator, when told that Oregon ranked 46th in K-12 funding, said, good, we have four to go. Given that context and given what's going on, I thought I would invite Scott and Juan Carlos here tonight to address a range of topics in our 30 minutes, including education funding, tax fairness, our jobless recovery, and the growing awareness that the middle class, including the unions that helped to build it, and indebted students who'd like to become a part of it, is in serious trouble. So let's start with Scott from Our Oregon. Scott, tell us a little bit about Our Oregon and then what you see happening right now in the state.
Yeah, sure. So thanks for having us on. It's great to be here and have this conversation. Our Oregon is an organization. We're a coalition organization. And what we do is we bring together groups from all around the state that cover a wide range of issues, from labor to services for seniors, services for kids, advocates for schools, advocates for the environment. We bring everybody together towards a common vision, a common mission, a common goal, and that's protecting what it is that makes Oregon great, a great place to live. And so we do that year in and year out. A lot of what we do is work on ballot measure issues, and that can mean fighting against really, really bad ideas as well as helping to advance the good ones. And, in the case of what happened this year, you're absolutely right. We really were facing a horrible, not just one anti-worker ballot measure, but potentially two or more measures that were direct attacks on working families. And you have to think of the context in which this is taking place. You know, things, you know, for the last 30 years or more have become completely out of whack. All of the economic gains, the economic benefits, are really being concentrated with very large corporations and the already wealthy. You know, right now, your listeners may know this, or it may come as a shock to them, but corporate profits as a share of the economy have never been higher since they've been recorded. But by the same measure, by the share of the economy, wages and incomes for working people have almost never been lower. And those things aren't accidental. They're actually directly related. Corporate profits are so astronomically high because wages for working people have been, they've either stagnated or they've actually fallen in many cases. You know, since the end of the so-called end of the recession, in this period of economic recovery that we're in, things have actually gotten a lot worse for working people, while things are